RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
This episode sponsored by Maximus Tribe. You train, you track, you eat right. But if you're over 40, you've felt it. The results don't match the effort anymore. That's not willpower, it's biology. Hormones drop, metabolism slows, your body stops responding the way it used to. Maximus is the online clinic that reverses your decline with prescription performance medicines, GLP-1s, testosterone, and peptides that reduce belly fat, restore energy, and boost recovery. Over 50,000 high performers have already broken through their plateaus. If you're ready to turn your hard work into measurable results, go to MaximusTribe.com. That's MaximusTribe.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to a brand new episode of Gaming in the Wild, a video games podcast about games from the artistic, creative side of the tracks, from indie to AAA. My name's John, I'm your host. I'm recording out in a snowy Reykjavik, Iceland. We had a big dump of fresh white snow in the city last night, but it's been a really mild winter, actually, so I'm not complaining. It's the nice kind of snow right now. It's the ice that we don't look forward to, but you know, one thing at a time. And I've got some really good games to talk about with you today. I've got a few games, actually. I know it's been a bit quiet on the podcast front, but I have been putting out pretty much a video a week over on YouTube, so there is always something for you to watch or listen to, hopefully every week. But the reason there hasn't been a podcast is because I've been flitting through lots of different games without really settling on anything in particular. But I did actually settle on something. I have finished it. And so this episode will have a featured game review of Duskpunk. This is a game that came out last year on Steam only. It is a Citizen Sleeper-like. I couldn't play it at the time because it didn't have controller support, but I have since then put together a little monitor and mouse and keyboard setup for the ROG Ally docked and was able to finally play it. Really enjoyed it. Fans of Citizen Sleeper, sit up and take note. So we will be talking about Duskpunk as the featured game of the episode. But I've also been playing a bunch of other stuff. I'm actually at the last chapter of Romeo is a Dead Man. You may have heard about this one if you've been paying attention to the discourse. It's a game that has come out at a Metacritic, I think, 71 or something. But a 71 often means an average game. And this is not that. It's a lot of 10s and 9s and a lot of 4s, 5s, and 6s. So it's not a median game, you know, with a lot of 7s. It's a game that has split the critics in half between thinking it's amazing and thinking it's terrible. And I can see why. It's an experimental game with, I would say, AA production values. So maybe people came in expecting like a slick AAA combat game in the vein of Flintlock or something like that. And this is not that. It's got a lot of rough edges. It's very jagged. It is loose. It is experimental. It's got all kinds of strange crap woven into it that is happening all of the time. It's confusing and expansive and like a little loose, basically. And I think maybe some critics have thought, this doesn't feel finished. I don't know what's happening. And some have thought, finally, someone is taking some risks. And so you've got 4s and 10s. I'm leaning towards the top side right now. But what is Romeo's a Dead Man? It's a new science fiction action game from Grasshopper Manufacture and the legendary Japanese auteur developer Suda51, who has earned a punk reputation, I would say. Hard to be a punk in game development when it is so methodical and there is so much money on the line. But Suda51 has pulled it off. This is a punk-ass video game, and I'm loving it. It was initially presented as a psychedelic splattercore hack-and-slash game in the, maybe the Devil May Cry kind of mold. It looks amazing and presented well on showcases, and all of that action is present and correct, but it's a lot more than that, actually. It's an experimental collage of video game styles, including a top-down pixel art hub, including odd poetic text that you get whenever you fast travel. You have to speak to the TV, to a headless man, including looping cutscenes that are almost David Lynch-like or Lynchian in how the same events play out differently every time, because it's a game about time travel and metaverse. It's irreverent, it's confusing, it's creative. And nothing that it does is perfect, but everything that it does is interesting. So I'm playing Romeo's Dead Man now, having a great time, making a lot of notes at the last chapter. And as soon as Next Fest is over, I'm going to sit down, polish it off, and I will have a full review for you on the podcast. And I've been craving a large-scale RPG this year as well, and I've sort of dallied with a couple of things. I tried to start Kingdom Come Deliverance, and it just didn't click with my mood at the time. I tried to start an East game, East Nordics, and I wasn't quite buying that one. So I decided to dip into a game that I've had in my library for quite a long time, and it is Persona 5 Royal, the JRPG all-timer, which I bounced off, but it was 5 years ago. It was in the first flush of my new gaming era back in 2020. I'd just finished Breath of the Wild. I'd just finished Hollow Knight, and I was just dipping my toe in the water. I found the game to be humdrum, menu-heavy, and hard to grok, basically, and I kind of bounced off it. But since then, I've played a lot more JRPGs. I played Metaphor ReFantazio, which was the perfect primer for this game because it is built on the same foundation. So by playing Metaphor ReFantazio, Tomato Tomato, I got into the rhythm of playing an Atlas RPG where you're min-maxing your days, you're growing your affinities, you're using your time wisely. You only get a certain amount of actions a day. So you have to build your inventory, power yourself up, get your friends powered up by becoming closer friends with them. And then you will go into dungeons, which you will have to hit 2, 3, or 4 times to complete sometimes, which is really unusual. I think most games you can kind of do a dungeon in one sitting in Persona and Atlas games generally. That's not the case. The game also has a lot of style, which I've really come to appreciate, having played a lot more RPGs since the last time I tried it. I've realized that what Atlas does as their superpower is to make an incredibly UI-heavy game with a lot of transitions, like a scene can be 30 seconds, and then another scene, and then another scene, and then a menu, and then a scene, and then a menu again. And it could be heavy, clunky, boring, but what Atlas does is put so much juice on every menu screen and in every transition that they're just a joy to look at. There is a lot of sugar on this game, on the UI. And I think that that makes playing it actually quite appealing because you're always enjoying what you're looking at, even if it's a loading screen. It's also set in Japan. It's set in central Tokyo. So you can go and wander around a beautiful anime Shibuya. I really like the cast so far, especially Morgana, who's like a kind of mysterious, magical cat who hangs out with you. So I am loving Persona 5 Royal. I've played 12 hours of it already. I know that it's a 100-hour game. That's a big ask. So I think I'm going to have it on the down low. It's going to be like a comfort game for me that I revisit throughout the year. And I've got like a personal low-key aim to try and finish Persona 5 Royal before the end of 2026 and to make an episode about it for you. Two more items in this intro block. The first is the ROG Ally X. I recently upgraded from the ROG Ally to the Ally X. I'd been thinking about it for a long time. I'd been agonizing about whether it was worth the money to do this incremental upgrade. But I did it in the end. I took the jump. I'd been looking on eBay. I'd been searching secondhand stores. I finally found an ROG Ally X that was pristine, half price, one careful owner. And so I bought it. It's here. It has replaced my other ROG Ally, which I'm going to hand off to a friend of mine who could use it to play some PC games. So I'm going to give you a mini review of what my last couple of months with the ROG Ally X has been like. To start off with, the unit feels better in the hands. It has been reshaped a little bit. It has bigger handholds on the back with textured plastic, so it sits more comfortably in the hand. They've replaced the yawning proprietary external GPU port on the top, which is just like a big black hole on the top of your console. They've taken that away because no one is buying ROG external GPUs. They're incredibly expensive. And they've put an extra USB-C slot there instead. So it looks a lot tidier on the top. It has extra RAM. It has like a 40% increase in available RAM, which gives it a noticeable uptick in performance, both in terms of using the Armoury Crate software, using Steam, using the Xbox app, using all of the perks that you get with a Windows handheld, which is like Itch, Game Pass, that kind of thing. It's got a noticeable uplift in performance whilst using apps and a really noticeable uplift in frames when playing games. It also has a 1 terabyte SSD instead of that 512, which has eliminated the need for memory cards. A terabyte, I think I've got 90 games on it right now, and I've still got 20 gigabytes spare. I do have a couple of big ones on there. I've got Frostpunk 2, I've got Persona 5, I've got one of the Mordor games I picked up in a Steam sale, and I've got Kingdom Come on there as well. So I've got a few big 20, 40 gigabyte games, but a lot of games that I play are 400 meg to 1 gigabyte, you know, indie games. So you can stack this thing with indie games. That larger SSD is really, really nice. It also has a battery that is almost double the size of the original ROG Ally, which has been the single biggest improvement on the device. It means that I no longer have to be constantly sweating about how close to a plug socket I am. It means if I take it on a flight, I know that I can get 2 to 2.5 hours of gaming out of it before I have to recharge it, rather than 1 hour like the old one. And it means that I can just use it around the house without constantly thinking it has to be plugged in. And it doesn't feel meaningfully heavier than the old device, which I think is surprising given how much tech is in here that wasn't in the other one. I will say that the software is still quirky, but it is less quirky than before. It's not exactly console-like still. For example, if you open Armoury Crate and then try to use it using the sticks, it's like a launcher. It has all your games in there. It has all your game platforms in there. When you open it, the unit doesn't recognize that that app has been opened, and you have to touch the screen to foreground the app before you can move the stick, like every single time. There seem to be two versions of Steam. If you open it from a desktop icon, it will launch into a strange windowed version. If you launch it from Armoury Crate, it will launch into a full screen native version. If you sleep the device, if you wake it up again, a game will crash, so it doesn't have instant restart. So I've turned my time before sleep right down. So lots of quirks still, but honestly, it is so much more slick than the original ROG Ally experience. I do think that the new Microsoft touchscreen gaming version of Windows that they've been working on is making a big difference. It's just taking down the friction, even if it is still a little bit quirky. So I'm loving life with my ROG Ally X, especially because I got an email from JS Orcs, the peripheral manufacturer. They've been in touch before. They've talked about sponsoring content, never quite done it, but they have sent me several big boxes of peripherals for free to try out and talk about on the podcast. The latest box, I told them, I'm getting an ROG Ally X. Could you send me a box of peripherals to review? They did so. And honestly, it has revolutionized the device again for me. They sent me a really cool dock. It has a little dongle that you pop into the top of the Ally. On the back, it has an HDMI output, power input, 2 USB ports, 2 USB-C ports. So I'm able to connect an alternate keyboard, a Razer Deathadder mouse. And as soon as I touch the power button on top of the Ally, the monitor wakes up and I'm in basically a desktop PC. And because of the extra power in the Ally, it can output at 4K. So I've actually been playing Persona 5 with an Xbox controller on my monitor in 4K at 40 frames per second using this tiny handheld, which is just blowing my mind. It also allowed me to play mouse-only games on Windows, because if you're using a Windows handheld, obviously you've got inbuilt controllers, you can't use mouse inputs, and there is a surprising number of games come out on Steam with only mouse and keyboard support, which blows my mind. It seems like such a bad commercial decision to not include controller support when we are in the age of the PC handheld. People are downloading from Steam, and they're playing on trains and planes and in bed, and they're buying games that they just can't play because they'll start it up and be like, oh shit, no controller support. Obviously, there are ways around it. There are user-made templates and things, but some games just do not support it flat out. And in fact, Duskpunk is one of those. The reason that Duskpunk is the featured game on this episode is because I was able to play it through this docked Windows mouse and keyboard setup. So it's worked out really well. JS Orcs also sent me a bunch of other stuff. They sent me a 2 meter cable with a right angle USB-C on it, which has turned out to be amazing, because if you're playing in bed and you have that USB-C jammed into the top of your ROG Ally, the wire is always pulling slightly away from the device, no matter how you set up. So having a 2 meter cable with a right angle USB-C that just goes flush into the top of the device reduces strain on the port visibly. So I'm really happy with the stuff that I got from JS Aux. Thanks very much to them for sending me some more stuff. Everything that they have sent me has been premium feeling and with a quality build. I think JS Aux is my single favorite peripheral make, even more so than Anker, which is another high quality one. I feel like JS Aux is a little bit more robust. So, you know, shout out to them and thanks for sending me the stuff. And it really is a heartfelt recommendation. If you're wondering, if you're looking at Amazon and looking at the sea of different manufacturers for switch cases, for chargers, for cables, I recommend defaulting to JS Aux because everything I've had has been great. Final item on the list here is that NextFest is underway. Steam NextFest, obviously, most wonderful time of the year, comes every quarter roughly. 3,000 plus Steam demos available for everyone to play. We always run a patron event around it because there are a lot of people in the Patreon who are playing demos. And there is a lot of noise in NextFest. It's hard to get to the good stuff. Like Steam does recommend games to you, but it's not always the highest quality stuff that they are surfacing. And so this is really a collaborative effort where we all rate games together. We can look at a big spreadsheet with drop-down menus where people have rated stuff from bad through to excellent. And you can see which games a lot of people are rating as excellent. For example, right now, Densha Tak, the train skating, stunting, QTE-heavy action game, is almost universally loved by people that have been playing it. And then replaced the gritty cyberpunk voxel pixel action game with a bit of platforming and a bit of fisticuffs. People have been loving that too. That's mostly beloved by everyone who has played the demo. But a few little surprising ones are starting to come out as well. It's a really fun time of the year, and anyone can join and take part if they're a patron of the show. So it's like, it's an event that's held in the patron Discord. I think we've got a record number of people taking part this year, and we're going to smash our record. I think we're going to have over 100 games played by the end of the fest, which will be a first. It's a really fun event. I'm taking part too. I'm playing games that people recommend. People are picking up games that I have heavily recommended, and there's a really good conversation going on in the Discord. Big thanks to patrons Slater and Soccer, who have been managing that quite thorny spreadsheet to spit out average marks for each game and that kind of thing. And after NextFest is over, we will get a chart of what the patrons thought was the best demo of the festival. I will produce a personal top five of my favorite demos of the festival. And so that will be the next episode of the podcast. But the other reason I'm mentioning it here is because there is still like 5 days of NextFest to go. And if you are listening right now and thinking, I would like to get involved with that, I would like to see what people are loving, I would like to add my own ratings and recommendations and get into the conversation, you can join the Patreon for just $1 a month at patreon.com/gamingintheWild. However, if you join at the $3 tier, I've got a free game code to welcome you, including Signs of the Sojourner, a conversational card game, Phantom Spark, a very, very slick, enjoyable time trial sci-fi racing game that is almost like an experience of flying. I absolutely love the sense of speed in that game. I've got one code left for Ultros. I've got a few codes left, 1,000 times resist. And I've got a few codes left for Many Nights of Whisper, the 2-hour game that blew my mind and ended up at the 10th spot in my Games of the Year list last year. So $3 tier or above, and you can get a game. If you are an existing patron, then you can upgrade, and I will also send you a code. I will also say that we are just 4 patrons off hitting 200 active patrons, which is such a nice landmark. So if you're a long-term listener of the show or a lapsed patron, then please hop back on. It would be really nice to hit that 200 patron landmark in 2026. As always, an extra special shout out to my boss tier patrons, Shy Guy, King Champ, Susanna Maria, Nate, Drelesh, Reistic Studies, and returning boss tier patron, Essie Woods. Thanks very much to Essie Woods for hopping back up to boss tier. And every patron also gets access to 20 plus bonus podcast episodes about books, movies, travel, all sorts of off-topic things. So lots more Gaming in the Wild behind the curtain as well. Link in the description, patreon.com/gamingintheWild. And with that, let's get on with the show and talk about the featured game of this episode, Duskpunk.
RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at ringcentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.
This episode sponsored by Maximus Tribe. You train, you track, you eat right. But if you're over 40, you've felt it. The results don't match the effort anymore. That's not willpower, it's biology. Hormones drop, metabolism slows, your body stops responding the way it used to. Maximus is the online clinic that reverses your decline with prescription performance medicines, GLP-1s, testosterone, and peptides that reduce belly fat, restore energy, and boost recovery. Over 50,000 high performers have already broken through their plateaus. If you're ready to turn your hard work into measurable results, go to MaximusTribe.com. That's MaximusTribe.com.
So Duskpunk is a game that was developed and published by solo developer James Patton, who goes under the name Clockwork Bird. It is out on PC only. It lacks controller support, which is why I am reviewing it like 6 months after release, because I initially tried to play it on my Ally, no controller support. It took me setting up a mouse and monitor setup to be able to play it, so be aware of that. You will have to be at a desk to play this game. It doesn't have enough reviews on Metacritic for a score, but it has 2 8s and a 9. So if it got one more 9 out of 10 review, which is the score that I think I would give it, then it would be like, you know, 87% on Metacritic. One of the good reviews was from Gaming Bible, who said, "By the time the game came to its conclusion, I was left with an overwhelming yearning for a better future, and the feeling that that is something that is wholly achievable. Duskpunk is the kind of game that makes me feel hope," unquote. The developers described this one by saying, "It's a gritty, dice-driven RPG in a steampunk city. You escape the war, but how to survive? Explore the city, build your skills, decide who to trust, and choose carefully. You might just spark a revolution." And I have to say of this game that it's an incredibly welcome citizen sleep-alike that casts those addictive, multifunctional dice and clock mechanics in a gritty steampunk city. It's a game that wears its politics and its big heart on its sleeve, and it was an unforgettable and gripping adventure. And for one time only, Gareth Damian Martin, the creator of Citizen Sleeper, says, "It's very much a game with its own strong vibes. Definitely recommended for Sleeper fans," end quote. So Duskpunk is a Citizen Sleeper-like adventure RPG that switches out the sci-fi setting for a steampunk city. You play as a wounded soldier who washes up on the shores of Dredgeport. It's a grim city riven by crime, corruption, and gangs. There is a wide class divide between factory workers and aristocracy. There is political turmoil. There is emerging technology, specifically processing human remains, referred to as like, into a liquid power source called plasm. So that is going on. There's a new kind of factory, and corpses have become a commodity. This has created a grim new industry around death. Your first task as a homeless person in the city is to try and stabilize yourself, as you are hungry, you are weak, you are half mad from what you've seen in the war, and you have flashbacks. And after stabilizing, you enter the city's underbelly. You try to survive. You can accept charity. You can panhandle. You can try and find work. You can try and carve out a place for yourself where you're not just surviving, but you're actually stabilizing. You're actually making a life. And as the game progresses, you can work on your stature within various communities. There are several factions in the game that are all pretty interesting, and you can eventually start to wield influence over the events unfolding around you. The game uses the same tabletop-inspired gameplay foundation of Citizen Sleeper. So if you've played Citizen Sleeper, you will feel immediately at home here. You will be rolling the dice against your skills as a primary method of ascertaining success in any situation. For example, walking down a street, someone might try and bump into you to take your wallet. You can have a little dice check, and whether they get away with it or not will depend on whether you hit the right score, a check against your skills to, you know, throw them off, keep your wallet, or whether they grab it and they slip away. The game also features clocks that gradually tick down for major story events, creating pressure and stakes. So you will get important jobs that you have to carry out within 8 in-game days, for example. If you don't make it in time, you will see the ramifications of that and you will fail the mission. There is also quite a detailed in-game economy with various currencies like money, like various forms of information from gossip to rumors to tip-offs. Public sentiment can become a currency as well, tools that you can manufacture into parts, which you can manufacture into devices, which are incredibly valuable and sometimes necessary for story progress, and various forms of valuables like antiquities and finery. And they all interact and interlock. So in various places around the map, you can buy and sell and exchange to try and get what you need to stay alive and ultimately to, you know, progress the game. A lot of these mechanics are based on the tabletop game Blades in the Dark, and that's where Gareth Damian Martin took a lot of inspiration for Citizen Sleeper. But Gareth was quite selective in which parts were taken and reworked for Citizen Sleeper, and Duskpunk has its own personality. It reworks the rules of Blades in the Dark in a different way. It makes some different foundational decisions, and so whilst it's based on the same rule set, it is very much distinct from Citizen Sleeper. For example, time works differently here. In Citizen Sleeper, you get a certain amount of dice at the start of the day. You can spend them how you see fit, and then your day will be over. In this game, that doesn't happen. You can roll the dice at any time. However, the things that you choose to do will advance time in the day-night cycle. It does have a day-night cycle where a location might be like a busy town square by day, and then take on a more seedy quality at night, which means that different actions are available, different characters might be around, and that brings the city to life a little bit. You know, we're not on a space station here, we are on a planet, we're on a landmass, we're in a city, and so day-night cycle makes a lot more sense here than in Citizen Sleeper, so perhaps that's why it came out this way. It made me perceive my days more clearly. The way that it is done in Duskpunk, like the day-night differences are really cool, and sometimes you will find yourself needing to do something that can only happen at night, and then using your days to try and, you know, fill your purse or advance a certain side quest. So it became very involved in a way that I really liked. And also, like Citizen Sleeper 2, dice can be broken in this game. In this game, your character is half mad, as I said. They've seen a lot in the war. They are in a lot of physical pain. They're in a lot of mental anguish. And they have a sanity meter, basically. And in the game, you have to score a drug to inject yourself, to calm yourself down and stop yourself from going crazy, at least in the early game there. So you have to find a source of it. It's a little bit like, I guess, the serum that you need in Citizen Sleeper to stay alive, except it's a heroin-like drug here that is used to stop your character from going mental. If you don't have enough to stay sane, you will break a dice, you'll get a skull will appear on one of your dice faces, on one of the faces of your two dice, rather. But unlike Citizen Sleeper 2, the dice can be fixed very easily by healing your condition. So it gives a little more, you know. Having broken dice that can't be fixed and a lot of glitch dice in Citizen Sleeper 2 was a particularly punishing take on dice breaking. And in Duskpunk, it's a little more giving, which I think will be music to the ears of some people who didn't quite jive with Citizen Sleeper 2 for those reasons. But sanity is not the only health meter that your character has. You also have literal physical health, and you have a hunger level. So you've got three different meters to manage, including the sanity meter as well. And you have to juggle finding resources like food, medical attention from a sawbones, and the soporific heroin-like medicine, which means that you need to mind your wallet, which means you need to mind things like you can't sleep if you're hungry because you will lose health. So you have to remember to eat throughout the day. Otherwise, you will lose physical health when you sleep. Every night, you have to find a place to sleep, which initially is pretty tenuous and difficult, but, you know, opens up as the game goes on. I'm not going to spoil all of the things that happen, but you go from like sleeping in a town square to other arrangements. You roll the dice when you sleep. If you roll low, you get nightmares, which increases your anxiety and sanity meter. If you roll high, then you will get sound sleep, which actually heals you. And at first, it's really hard to have a sound sleep, which I think was an interesting way to express the condition of your protagonist through the dice. There is also a quest structure. You have a little Citizen Sleeper style diary that tells you the different quests that you have. You can click on them and then you'll get a pin on the map showing you where to go to progress your quest. You have story quests, side quests, sub aims, and things like that. And you have to just find enough money to stay alive, whether it's through petty crime, buying and selling, doing jobs for people, and so forth. And that really works, you know. Duskpunk really does get to that sleeper-like place where you feel pulled in various directions at once. And the game has so much going on at any given time, where you're zipping around the map, you're clicking on places, you're meeting people, you're trying to make money, you're trying to do quests, you're trying to manage your meters. that I went into a flow state with it. Constantly making micro decisions pulls you into the world. And as the story unfolded around me, I was engaged, I felt empowered, and it really did feel like the choices I was making put the destiny of my character in my own hands. I felt present in this game's world, rather than watching from afar as the story pulls you along. Rather than being on rails in a narrative game, I felt like an active participant in a really vibrant living world. I enjoyed the progression a lot in this game as well. The city is cleverly segmented into three boroughs, like the poor area, the industrial area, the docks, and then the political area, which is last, where the rich people live and where the seats of power in Dredgeport are. And that meant that the play area grows as the player does. Like on Erlyn's Eye, you start off with a rough area to explore, but no specific locations to visit. So you might be like in the rich area of town, you'll spend some dice to explore, and then a playhouse will be revealed, or the government office will be revealed, or, you know, the presidential palace will be revealed, or a small town square will be revealed, and you can then go and further explore those places, unlock them by, you know, becoming a regular at a bar, for example. And then as the bar opens up and people start to trust you, you might be able to find gossip and rumors there. You might be able to eat there. You might be able to sleep there. So it really is a matter of slowly unlocking the map by spending your dice wisely, which really does feel like exploring the city. It really worked out for me. The city also has a personality. You know, you will find like a burned down quarter and you will wonder what it is. And by investigating it at day and at night and prying into its mysteries, you can figure out the history of this city, which I think really helped with the personality of Dredgeport. You do get the sense of a city that is built on a troubled history, a little bit like Revachal and Disco Elysium. And the various factions that you will meet sketch out the shape of this society and how these factions came to be as well. There are the Watchers. One of the first people you will meet is a Watcher. These are a monk-like religious sect that are good on the face of it, that are charitable, that try and help the homeless. But also, there is a price for that help. You know, they do exhibit some cult-like tendencies as well. So the Watchers are an interesting faction. There are the factory workers and the dock workers, the working class of Dredgeport, who are oppressed, exploited, tired, and not yet organized, but maybe could become organized. There are the brutal like dealers who trade in bodies and secrets, and the Soma-like drug that you need to stay sane. And then there are some others that I won't spoil for you. Every faction has a route to joining, but they also come with drawbacks. For example, the light dealers, you may gain power and influence if you join the light dealers, but you will also have to do bad things. So there is like a personal, ethical aspect to the decisions you will make and the factions you will align yourself with. And I thought that was really interesting. Nothing comes easy. Everything has a bit of a twist in the tail. I found the main characters of this game to be memorable and well rendered. I liked the tasks that they give you, the side quests they give you. They are things that that character wants. There are things that you can decide to do or not do based on whether you think it is right. But if you do complete one of those, you will get a skill point. Your character has various skills like physical skirmishing, sneaking, persuasion, charm, that kind of thing. So you can add points and get extra dice abilities and decide what kind of character you would like to roleplay. So there is like a functioning roleplay element to the game as well, about what kind of person you want to be in Dredgeport. Some of that is tied into the politics of the game. It has some quite on-the-sleeve Marxist politics here about working-class consciousness, aristocracy, exploitation. You can hear speeches, you can join groups, and ultimately you will have to pick a side in some fairly tumultuous events in Dredgeport as well. Funnily enough, several of the game's most negative Steam reviews are from people who loved the game, loved the mechanics, loved the art, the sound, the story, but really didn't like the fact that they were made to engage in left-wing politics, or at least they felt they were made to engage with it. It's funny to me that they decided to go with the workers when there are choices to go with other parties as well, and then came online and complained about it. But for the record, the Steam reviews are overall very positive, so most people who played this game seem to have their head screwed on. And a few words about the art. Whilst on that subject, you get character portraits that are nicely made, I would say. You get location images, which is something that Citizen Sleeper 2 did not have. So you will see like a painted version of the exterior of a factory or, you know, a marketplace, etc., which I really enjoyed. I get the feeling they are digital Procreate drawings, if you know what I mean. And I will say that I did have to go and check if AI was used, just because of the general sort of digital art, smoothed off look of the art. But there are artist credits on the game. There are no AI disclosures. So I guess we're giving it the benefit of the doubt here and saying it's just a stylistic similarity, because digital painting and what AI generates can look similar at times. The sound of the game is good. It has that Citizen Sleeper style atmospheric sound, like the clanging of a factory, the raucous hubbub of a pub, the busy streets, etc. And it chills down at night with owl cries and nefarious rustling sounds and things like that. So the sound really helped to evoke the atmosphere of the city. The music was, good, fine. It worked with the atmosphere of the game. Not memorable, not a soundtrack that I'm going to be sticking on, but it worked for the game, and that's good enough for me. So whilst Duskpunk is not like a lush aesthetic triumph like Citizen Sleeper was, in terms of, you know, the look, the sound, the music, the drawings, the writing all rhymed so well in Citizen Sleeper and were all exemplary, I would say that Duskpunk isn't quite at that level, but everything is good. So whilst it's not perhaps a home run in the same way that Citizen Sleeper was aesthetically, it gets the job done very, very well. But I do want to talk about this game's rough edges as well. I think it is harsh to compare this game to Citizen Sleeper, which had fellow traveller involved. It had a publisher. And so I'm sure there was some, you know, testing, some QA, some console ports, some bug fixing, maybe extra breathing space based on having additional budget. And so I think it is understandable. This is largely a self-funded game, and the Culture Fund of Vienna, I believe, contributed to it as well to give the developer time to make the game. But it does have a lot of rough edges that weren't present in Citizen Sleeper. This kind of game has, by nature, a lot of permutations where player choice will result in an astounding number of scenarios. And so the game features quite a few continuity errors. One example, there's a scene where a monk friend of yours is comforting a dying man. You can choose to enter the scene and go to the man's side. You can choose to hang back and watch from afar. I was feeling a little suspicious of my monk friend at this time and didn't really want to get too involved with his religion, so I hung back. But then the text flashed perspective forward and said that, like, the monk looks into your eyes as he holds the man's hand and the wife is sitting at your side. And I was like, wait a second, that's not what I chose to do. In my mind, I'm sitting at the back of the church on a pew, but the game has whipped me forward as if I had made the other choice. So that happens a few times, like the perspective shifts around a little bit as if every permutation wasn't fully written. I think there were also some pretty major missing location descriptions. Like, for example, there is a place called the amphitheater. If you go there, there is no description of the amphitheater. There is just an option to eat rat. And I was like, what the fuck kind of, what kind of amphitheater is this? Like, are there not people here? Are there not players here? I mean, I guess the concept was that it was disused, which you do find out later, but that's not in the description of the place. There's another place called the Sleeping Dog, which I guess is like a DOS house where you can sleep for cheap, take drugs, calm yourself down, etc. But there is no description of it. So you go to the Sleeping Dog, and all you can see is sleep or take drugs, and you're like, well, where am I? So there is a jarring lack of context. That is a pretty big oversight, I would say. Places need descriptions, and several were missing. Also, the systems aren't quite as clean as in Citizen Sleeper. It's not always clear what a major clock is for. Like, if you hover over a clock, you don't see what quest it is related to. So I took a 3-day break from playing this game, and then forgot a few things. And then when I reopened it, there was a big clock ticking down, something to do with the watch. I thought it's probably just an unavoidable story event. I'll just keep playing. When that clock ticked down, I failed 3 quests and realized that it was essential for those quests that I did certain things in that time. But if there was no way to refresh yourself on that. So you really do have to, you know, play this game in as few sittings as possible, because it is not going to hold your hand or support play unless you are really on point with exactly what things on screen mean. It's not going to give you extra cues. It's not going to let you refresh yourself. There are some missing links, basically, between important clocks and quests. Like, if you hovered over the clock and then there was a pop-up for which quests it was related to, that issue would have been avoided. And there is like a Pyre-style hypertext system where you can hover over important words and it will tell you what they mean. So that could have been instituted for the clocks as well. The final rough edge I have is some story mix-up moments. Like, at one point I went into a pub, I was trying to talk my way into a secret meeting. Suddenly I flashed across town to another secret meeting under a bridge. And then when that meeting was over, was then whisked back to the tavern as if, I just teleported across the city. I don't know if it's because that event secret meeting was labeled the same in 2 different paths and they got tangled up or something like that. If that is the case, then shout out to the game for being robust enough to not crash but it definitely broke my immersion in that moment. So there are some story mix-up moments here, and I think that that's kind of common in these Tangled RPG games. Like, it's something that we're used to in Bethesda games. Like, if you're doing an escort mission, but the place that you're going to is destroyed, then suddenly you've got this, like, lost sheep NPC who is just by your side forever. So, I mean, even Bethesda games have problems recognizing and accounting for all of the possible story permutations that the game throws up. Citizen Sleeper had a couple of those, but very, very few. And Duskpunk has a lot of them. As I said at the start here, it's understandable, but it is something to watch out for. Few rough edges on this game, but none of them tanked the experience. I think I had one hard crash in my whole playthrough, and I just had a raised eyebrow as I saw these things happening. It's a solo dev project. It doesn't have a publisher, so some understandable roughness to it, I would say. And interestingly, James Patton did publish a post-mortem 1 month after release on Steam, which addressed some of what I'm talking about. In relation to what I've just been saying, James said, quote, "I wish I'd realized that weaving the main quest into the side quests this closely would require a ton more writing to account for various player choices," unquote. James has also said, quote, "Duskpunk has sold about 1,500 units since launch 4 weeks ago. It's got 17,000 wishlists and a 91% positive rating on Steam. It cost about €100,000 to make, but I got a grant from the Vienna Business Agency for about 66,000. That means it needs to sell about 4,500 more units to break even. I'd feel better if it had reached 2,000 by now, but these are still solid numbers for a narrative title. I think it will break even in about 2 years. Not ideal, but it will be a decent financial foundation for me as a solo dev," end quote. This is a $20 game, I think, and I played it for, I want to say, 6.5 hours. The game would stand a replay. There are certainly some missions that I failed. There are some factions that I didn't bring up to snuff before the ending. I did get a good ending. I'm sure there is a bad one, but it took a little bit of strenuous concentration towards the end of the game and real understanding of all of the mechanics that were on offer to actually pull off the ending that I wanted. But I would be very curious to see where else this story goes. So I do think it has replay value, if that is something that concerns you. And hearing that story from James, I just hope that some people who are listening to this go and buy Duskpunk and support this solo developer. This is a very, very ambitious project for a solo dev. And I would love to see it do well for them, because it really does deserve it. It's a good game. I think Gareth's remark that it was very much its own world is true. It is a rich game world. It has a vibe. It has a personality. And it's a big recommendation from me. Just to finish off that post-mortem there, James did say, quote, "I did a good job of boiling down the basics of Marxism in a few key scenes and smuggling them in. I wanted to portray a revolutionary workers' movement that made sense, felt like an actual mass movement, and wasn't just a bunch of freedom fighters blowing stuff up," end quote. So if that sounds interesting to you, that is a really cool aspect of this game as well. It does look at resistance, it does look at organization, and it's nice to see that in a game for sure. So just to round out this review with the good things and the bad things, good, the scenario, the vibe, the setting, Dredgeport is amazing. It's a living city. It has history. It has a Disco Elysium style depth to its history that you can find in optional locations like temples, statues, the burned down quarter. There is a lot of lore here and a lot of narrative for you to untangle. The sleeper-like gameplay is tight, it's addictive, it's active, it brings you into the moment, it makes you feel like an active participant in the story. It has vivid characters in terms of both writing and art. The pacing of the game is good, with three different areas to explore that are very distinct. I liked the difficulty curve of stabilizing in the game. It felt like progress, and it gave me that feeling that I got in Citizen Sleeper. If you have been craving that feeling of how that game felt to play, then this is a good game to play. The economy and the systems are engrossing. The political dimension is fleshed out and essential to the game's personality, actually. Political consciousness lies at the core of this game, and I was very happy with the resolution that I got and curious about the others. As for the bad things, those rough edges do add up, so be aware of that going in. Be kind to them when they happen. There are those missing location descriptions. There are the tangled clocks, UI miscommunications about which clock is connected to which task. But I think overall it dented the experience, but it did not tank it. So if you're aware of that going in, then I think you can be prepared, you know what I mean? And to conclude, overall, I'm very happy that I played this game. I hope that it is not the last sleep-alike. I hope that this developer breaks even. I hope that maybe even they get enough money to fix some of the issues that I've mentioned. That post-mortem blog post does talk about correcting a few pieces of writing and going back into the game with a patch. So if the developer is listening to this, then well done on this amazing game. I hope that those points that I made were useful to you. I do also wonder if controller support might not open a bigger audience for the game. You know, 15% of the people on Steam are playing on controllers. Many of those are Steam Deck people, and I think it would help the reach of this game amongst enthusiasts. And the people who buy Steam Decks are enthusiasts. They're willing to spend money on gaming. They're probably buying more games, you know? So I would say that controller support would be very welcome, and maybe even pave the way for a console release one day. Who knows? If enough people play it, maybe a publisher would get involved. Overall, I love the game. I will play it again. I want to do a villain run, maybe. I really enjoyed this game. It had such a strong vibe, such a strong personality. It would definitely have made the honorable mentions if I'd played it before Games of the Year time. I hope this review has piqued your interest. That is Duskpunk. It. That is our episode. I hope you enjoyed it. Really fun one to make, really fun to recap all of the things that I've been playing, talk about Romeo's a Dead Man a little bit. That's such a good game, man. I'm definitely on the high side of the reviews on that one, and I will be fleshing out my little chat there into a full review for you. But first up, we have Steam Next Fest, which is happening now. I'm definitely going to be playing a lot more demos. I've got a few more on the slate. I think I've got 10 downloaded. I've been playing them at night, you know, after my girlfriend goes to bed, and I've got like a few hours to myself. I've been playing, you know, 3 demos a night if I can. I will say that I have gone back to Racoin a bunch of times, which I have to stop doing. It is from Playstack, the publishers of Balatro, and Racoin is, it's like a degenerate coin-pushing roguelike. You know, coin-pushing machines that you get at the seaside? It's like that, except you can get different powers, like giant coins, like towers of coins, like shaking the machine to make all of the coins tumble down, and you have to find a way to multiply your score and keep up with the antes. And I keep going back to it again and again and again. It's really eating into my demo time, because that one demo is so compelling. So that's one of the ones that's top of the pile for me, for sure. I also have a code for Resident Evil Requiem, which landed on my desk, so thanks to Capcom for that. I will be playing that at some point as well. It's just been such a busy time, I haven't been able to open it. It's so weird to be sitting on a code that the world is, you know, dying to play and not having time to actually boot it up. But that's the way it's been. I have that Persona 5 Royal playthrough to talk about as well. That will be going on throughout the year. So lots more to look forward to. Sorry if you're a podcast listener that there haven't been as many episodes recently, just one in January and just one in February. But I do want to say that even though my focus is somewhat shifting towards YouTube, I am going to keep making podcasts, so don't worry about the podcast vanishing. I will say that if you miss having a weekly podcast, then just tune into the YouTube channel. If you're a premium YouTube member, then you get ad-free YouTube and you can listen. You can listen without having to watch, so you can lock your phone, have your headphones in, and just listen to what I'm saying in the videos. So if you are, you know, wanting more Gaming in the Wild, then YouTube is an option. There is a lot of videos going up there all the time, so hopefully that is enough to tide my podcast listeners over. And I think with that, it's time for me to sign off. So thanks very much for listening. Take care of yourselves and each other, and bye-bye for now.
RingCentral's AI receptionist uses voice AI to answer on the first ring, so you'll never miss a call again. In just a few minutes, you can personalize your own AI receptionist to answer questions, route calls, schedule appointments, and even send texts in multiple languages. Plus, it's easy to scale. Create unlimited AI receptionists across any phone system. It's all powered by one reliable platform for effortless AI communications. See for yourself at RingCentral.com. RingCentral, voice of your business.